Why do we go so crazy over chametz? Why do we spend days cleaning the home, kashering the kitchen? Why are there so many biblical and rabbinic laws and stringencies surrounding chametz? There are a number of mitzvot min haTorah related to the prohibition of chametz, and then additional isurei derabanan, rabbinic prohibitions. Can't eat it, you can't own it, you can't derive any benefit from it. We search the home and destroy any chametz that's left over. And then, of course, you've got the minhagim, the customs, the chumrot like kitniot, gebrochts, or shruya, and all sorts of stringencies. We spoke about chumrot a few weeks ago. Some sensible, some senseless, some just insane. To borrow from the Haggadah, or really from the Mishnah and Pesachim, why is this prohibition different from all other prohibitions? The Radbaz, Rav David ibn Shlomo ibn Zimra, who lived from 1479 to 1573 and served as a rabbi in Cairo. We actually spoke about him just the other week when we discussed the prohibition of a Jew traveling to Egypt, visiting Egypt, living in Egypt. He was a rabbi himself in Egypt, in Jerusalem, here in Yerushalayim, and in Tzfat. And he asks this very question. So take a look at source number one. Okay, this is a tshuva from the Radbaz. Very important, Acharon. Sha'alta mimeni, odiyacha da'ati, ma nishtana chametz bapesach mikol isurin shebetorah? I was asked, make my opinion known. Ma nishtana, right? So you see, he too borrows from the Haggadah or from the Mishnah. Why is chametz on Pesach different from all other prohibitions in the Torah? Shichmira alav Torah latzricho b'dika v'saruf v'kila v'gam bitul v'osifu chachamim latzricho b'dika b'chorin u'bizdakin l'chapesach harav u'lesharesh oto mikol gvulav. The Torah has all sorts of mitzvot or prohibitions surrounding chametz. It has to be destroyed. Okay, then the Chachamim came along and added the mitzvah of bedikat chametz, searching in all the cracks and crevices, all the nooks and crannies of the home, and searching after it and destroying it, and it can't, as you know, can't be owned by a Jew, according to the Torah. The avar alav bival yira'eu bal yimatzeh, right? And a Jew who owns chametz on Pesach is in violation of bal yira'eu bal yimatzeh, can't be found on him, can't be in his possession. All sorts of interesting questions in the Gemara. If there is chametz of a non-Jew in the home of a Jew, or a Jew has his chametz in another place, it's not in his home, but let's say, you know, it's in the possession of a non-Jew, it's in a non-Jew's home, or it's in some sort of hole or some sort of cave, or ich weiß nicht, a contemporary question would be, what if a Jew has stock in a company that does business with chametz? A Jew has shares of a major supermarket chain, let's say. Okay? Interesting questions. Does he have to sell his stocks to a Gentile before Pesach as well? Very interesting questions. The asrua b'kol shehu, and even the smallest amount of chametz is prohibited. The eno mitbatel klal, and chametz does not become batel with other types of things that are prohibited, other types of isur. We say that isur shinitarev beheter, if you've got a mixture, an admixture, a tarovet of isur and heter, right? You've got some, a piece of treif of meat that you were going to feed to your dog that got mixed up into your chalent. If that falls into your chalent, if you've got 60 parts kosher against one part treif, so long as you don't see it, so long as it doesn't add taste, so long as you can't fish it out, all sorts of things, but we say that at least in a davar lach, it's batel b'shishim, it loses its identity, it's as if it's not there. With dry items, it's chad b'trei batel, bitul b'rov, okay? But there's a concept of bitul. By chametz, there is no bitul if chametz falls into your food on Pesach. Now, maybe there's a concept of bitul before Pesach begins. On Pesach, we say, no, there is no bitul. Before Pesach, there is an opinion, it's an interesting discussion beyond the scope of our discussion this morning, but the question is, maybe before Pesach it becomes batel, or no, do you say that before Pesach, there's no isur chametz, right? And batel, bitel only works, something can only become batel if it's Isur that gets mixed into Heter. Before Pesach, Chametz is not Asur. There's no prohibition against Chametz, right? You're allowed to eat bread the rest of the year. So maybe Bittul before Pesach doesn't apply either. Interesting. Major Machloket. But the Radbaz is listing different prohibitions and stringencies, biblical and rabbinic, that surround Pesach, surround Chametz. It would seem that Chametz is without precedent. Chametz is this very unique type of prohibition. We're so careful, it's so strict. As I mentioned the other week, people make the mistake, instead of calling Pesach Chag HaCherut, they confuse it with Chag HaChumrot. Okay? And then he adds, so, V'chumrot ke'elu lo nimtzu b'chol ha'isurin sheb'Torah. And all of these stringencies we don't find by any other prohibition in the Torah. Again, it's without precedent. And then he offers perhaps some svara, or some svarot, some rationalization or explanation as to why there are so many prohibitions surrounding chametz, biblical, rabbinic, and so many stringencies. Okay? And he says, de'im yishum de'id be'karet. Now, if you suggest that the reason why there are so many prohibitions surrounding chametz is because it imposes the punishment of karet. One who eats chametz on Pesach is chayav be'karet. Karet, spiritual excision, it's a very serious offense. You know, karet is given for things where a person demonstrates that he wants to detach himself from the Jewish people. He doesn't identify with the Jewish people. He eats on Yom Kippur, gets karet. He eats chametz on Pesach, he gets karet. He does not eat from the korban Pesach. He does not circumcise himself. His father didn't circumcise him, and then he, once he becomes an adult, doesn't circumcise himself. So these are things where a person demonstrates that he is not interested in identifying with the Jewish people, and so he too is cut off, so to speak. So the Radbaz says, well, maybe the reason why there are so many prohibitions surrounding the Isur of Chametz is because it imposes a punishment of karet, which is very serious. However, he says, Harei chelev vidam. We have other examples of Isurim that also impose the punishment of karet if you eat them, like forbidden fats, chelev, and dam, blood, and what? And you don't find that there's all sorts of prohibitions. You can't own it. You got to search the house for it, right? We don't say like you can't own a piece of chelev. A person, let's say, has a dog owner, and he wants to feed his dog a piece of treif, some chelev. It's not treif. It could be even from a kosher animal that was shechted and is kosher badatz, right? Eidah charedis, mahajim and amahajim, except that certain parts of the animal we don't eat. So maybe you want to, give it to your dog or something. So, or blood or something. So the chelev and the dam, you can't eat it, but and it imposes karet, right? If you do, it's a very serious punishment. However, we don't find that you have to, you know, rid your home of it, and you have to do a search and destroy. Okay, the imishum da'asur behana'a. And if you say, well, maybe the reason why there are so many prohibitions surrounding chametz is because there's a prohibition to derive benefit from it. Chametz is asur behana'a. You can't get any benefit from it. Right? You can't feed it to your animal. You can't, use it as payment. Right? You can't get any benefit from it on Pesach. So, wait a minute. Hare kilei hakerem, kilei hakerem, v'shor haniskal, v'kama isurei hana'a, shelo ichmira Torah behem kol kach. Wait a minute. We have other examples of prohibitions where there is an isur hana'a, where you're not allowed to derive benefit from it. If you have a mixture in your field, you've mixed your wheat and your grapes together, kilei akerem, and that also imposes an isur hana'a. You're not allowed to derive any benefit from it. Or the shor haniskal, if an ox gored a person and took human life, that ox is stoned. And the Torah says about that ox, lo ye'achelet bisaro, you are not to eat from its flesh. So there's also an isur hana'ah there, but what the Radbaz says, but we don't find that the Torah has all sorts of prohibitions, and you don't have to, you know, search and destroy, and there are all sorts of other isurei hana'ah in the Torah, where the Torah, shelo hichmira Torah behem kol kach, where the Torah is not so strict with them. It's enough just that you're not to have benefit from it, period. So it would seem that chametz is without precedent. And then he offers another svara, v'imishum delo b'dile mine, kule shata. Now maybe the reason why we're so strict with chametz on Pesach is that a person is not prohibited with chametz the rest of the year, right? For 51 weeks out of the year, he's allowed to eat leaven. He's allowed to eat bread. He's allowed to eat chametz. Only 1 week out of the year, there's this prohibition of chametz. So the Radbaz says, well, maybe the reason why we're so strict with chametz is because the rest of the year it's permitted to him. But then he says, but wait a minute. Hare yayin lenazir, delo badil mine. What about wine by a nazir, right? The nazir takes a vow of nizirut and abstains from wine for the period while he's a nazir. But he's used to drinking the rest of the year before he takes his oath, before he begins his vow. And we don't have all these prohibitions. We don't say he can't own wine. He's just not allowed to drink it. We don't make him spill it out or sell it to a non-Jew, right? We don't make him search his home for the wine. Now, this is interesting because this svara is mentioned by Tosfot at the very beginning, in the comments of Tosfot, the Masechet Pesachim, the very beginning of the Masechet, in explaining why there's a mitzvah of bedikat chametz. Because, really, Tosfot asks, well, it should be sufficient to just destroy the chametz. Right? We have this mitzvah of tashbitu min haTorah, we accomplish it through the bi'ur chametz. And how do we do biur chametz? We make this verbal declaration, declaring chametz ownerless, like the dust of the earth does not exist. Poof, we magically declare it that it no longer exists. We poof it out of existence. And so Tosfot asks, why is that not sufficient? Why can't you just say that any chametz in my home, it's ownerless, it doesn't exist, it's like the dust of the earth, afra da'ara. Why do you have to search the home if you're only going to subsequently, a few minutes later, do the biur and declare it ownerless and make it as if it doesn't exist? And just so it explains, no. The Chachamim instituted bedikat chametz because they understood human psychology. That this indeed is a prohibition that exists only 1 week out of the year. Right? 51 weeks out of the year, you're allowed to eat bread. 1 week out of the year, chametz is prohibited. So what? Chazal understood human psychology. That a person might come downstairs early Pesach morning after having stayed up late at the Seder, and he's tired and he's groggy, and he goes down to make himself a cup of coffee. And then he's searching through his cupboards for something to have with his coffee. Oh, and what does he find? He finds a little packaged muffin, you know, one of those hermetically sealed muffins that you get in the Shalach Manos, in the Mishloach Manot, that he got a month before on Purim. And because he's tired, and because he's so used to eating chametz with his coffee every morning, chametz is something that's only prohibited 1 week out of the year, he comes to eat chametz on Pesach. So explains Tosfot, that's why you need to make bedikat chametz, even though you are going to make all the chametz in your possession ownerless. And like the dust of the earth, you still need to check. Why? Because you might find in the language of the Gemara a gluska yafa, a nice little pastry, a nice little muffin, a nice little me'afeh. And you want to have a cafe au me'afeh, right? And so understanding human psychology, Chazal said it's not enough to just make this verbal declaration. Yes, maybe that suffices to not violate the prohibition of Bal Yireh or Bal Yimatzeh. But it doesn't suffice, this concern of a person making a mistake, because chametz is something that is permitted the rest of the year. And so the Radbaz suggests, well, maybe that's the reason why there are so many mitzvot min haTorah, and so many mitzvot min derabanan, and so many stringencies surrounding this prohibition. Okay? But then he says, well, maybe that's not the best answer, because you have wine by a nazir, and a nazir, even though he is prohibited from drinking wine during his nizirut, he doesn't have to spill out all the wine in his home, or doesn't have to make a bidikat yayin before his vow begins, okay, or comes into effect. And he says, "Hare yayin lenazir de lo bedil minei, v'hachadash de lo bedilei min hatvua kula shata, v'lo chamira kula hayin." What about the new grain, right? Not to have the new grain crop that grows until the Korban HaOmer is offered. Question, what do we do nowadays when we don't have a Korban HaOmer? But even though it's only prohibited for a very short time during the year, and the rest of the year, grain is permitted, we don't find, again, all sorts of stringencies associated with that prohibition. So he writes, "Tshuva shnei dvarim ne'emru b'tshuva davar zeh." He says, I'm going to give you two answers, two approaches to why the prohibition of chametz is different from all other prohibitions. Why is it so unique? Why do we find so many Torah prohibitions associated with chametz and biblical and rabbinic Yisurei Torah, Yisurei Drabanan, and then all sorts of chumrot? I'm going to provide two answers. Okay. Achat, the first answer, shelonim su b'kol ha'isurin shebatorah sheitztarfu bo kol gimel tnaim halalu. Oh, this is the first answer, is a technical answer. It's a halachic answer. You don't find any other example where you have all three conditions met. All those three things that he said about chametz. What are they? Shehu isurei hana'a, that number one, there's a prohibition to derive benefit from it. Plus, v'hu b'karet, and it imposes a punishment of karet. V'lo b'dile, in shemine kula shata, ela chametz bilvad. And also, the third issue is that it's only prohibited that 1 week out of the year. The rest of the year, chametz is permitted for you to eat. So the fact that you have all of these three things, these three conditions, that there's an isur hana'a, that it imposes karet, and that it's something that's permitted the rest of the year, and we're not used to abstaining from chametz, because we eat it the whole year, except those of us trying to lose weight and not eating too many carbs, right? Those of us on a keto diet. So the fact that it has all three, that's without precedent. You only find that by chametz on Pesach. V'keivan sheyesh bo hachumrot halalu ichmira alav Torah chumrot acherot. And once you have all of these three conditions met, so then the Torah is stringent with this prohibition. Okay? And the Torah has all sorts of prohibitions associated with chametz. Ubao chachamim. And like Tosfos says, the rabbis come along once the Torah has a number of prohibitions surrounding chametz, the rabbis come along, v'hosifu chumrot al chumrot, kimo she'asta ha-Torah, and they added additional prohibitions as the Torah did. It's a unique isur without precedent. And I will add to the Radbaz, and then over the generations, the Jewish people, im lo nevi'im heim, b'nei nevi'im heim, added additional prohibitions, minhagim, chumrot, kitniot, agabrachts, shruya, and all sorts of other chumrot, as I said, some sensible and some senseless. Okay? But then the Radbaz provides another answer. And take a look at the very end of the tshuva. And this is fascinating. He writes, there's another reason why we are so strict with chametz on Pesach, and why the Torah is so strict, and the rabbis were so strict. Ki chametz b'Pesach remez l'yetzer hara. Chametz on Pesach alludes to the evil inclination, the yetzer hara. V'hu se'or shebi'isa, and it is the leaven in the dough. We'll revisit that term in a few moments. V'lachen, and therefore, kala gareshi garesh oto ha'adam me'alav. A person has to get rid of it, rid all the chametz. V'chapes alav b'chol machbuot machshvotav. And he has to search for it in all the hidden places, in his machshava, in his mind, in his heart, in his soul. V'afilu kol shehu lo batil. And even the smallest amount of chametz, as we said, does not become nullified. It's not null and void. Right? Chametz is asur b'kol shehu. So too the negative character traits, even the smallest shemetz of a negative character trait, it has to be gotten rid of, has to be worked on, has to be improved. Okay? V'afilu kol shehu lo batel, v'harei ze emet v'nachon. And this is true and correct. Now this is fascinating. The Radbaz, as I mentioned, was a rabbi, lived in the 15th into the 16th century, and was major posek, wrote thousands and thousands of tshuvot, and I can't call him a Kalta Litvak, because he lived in Egypt, as I mentioned, and then lived in Israel. But you would certainly call him a halachist. In his thousands of tshuvot, he's not giving you mussar. He's not writing about, machshava, Jewish thought, or musar, personal development, personal growth. Okay, he's a halachist. He's a posek. He's one of the major acharonim, as I mentioned. And yet, he ends off this tshuva with another dimension. A new way of looking at chametz on Pesach. And why there are so many prohibitions, biblical and rabbinic, surrounding chametz. And why we're so stringent with chametz. He offers a spiritual dimension. And explains that chametz ultimately represents the yetzer hara. That stuff that we got to get rid of. So as you scrub and scour your homes and your ovens, it's a time to turn inwards and kind of scrub and scour the soul. A time to reflect on those things about ourselves that we would like to change. Areas in our lives that could use some improvement, some cleaning, if you will. Okay. We spend a lot of time getting the schmutz off of our stovetops, right? But the Radbaz says here that you also have to spend some time this time of year reflecting and getting rid of the schmutz inside of you. And so here in source number 2 is the Mishnah from the very beginning of Masechet Pesachim, which says, Or la arba'asar bodkim et hachametz le'or haner. The night of the 14th, this Thursday night, tomorrow night, you have to search the home by candlelight, le'or haner. And the Gemara explains there in the first perek that a candle provides a good light for bedikat chametz, as opposed to, for instance, a torch, an avuka, which maybe you use at Havdalah, something with a lot of wicks. You could argue maybe that would be better. It provides more light. But the Gemara explains why, no, actually a candle with one single wick is preferable because it doesn't sputter and flicker like a torch. A person uses a torch, they might be scared to go in all of those nooks and crannies, right? All of those chorim uzdakim, all of the cracks and crevices of his home. Doesn't want to go under the bed with a torch, so he won't make a complete bedikat chametz. Another reason, the light of a torch is not focused. It goes behind you, doesn't go in front of you. And there's a discussion among contemporary poskim if maybe it's preferable nowadays to use a flashlight. After all, a flashlight is safe, so you're not concerned about burning down the house, chas v'shalom, safety first, right? We spoke about that the other week when we spoke about chumrot on Pesach. Unfortunately, people keep crazy chumrot, and some of them are even dangerous, okay? So maybe a flashlight is preferable, you know? You don't want to go under the bed with a candle, right? Or underneath the sofa with a candle, okay? And it's a focused light. It's a very good, clear, focused light. Doesn't sputter, doesn't flicker. But some suggest, based on the sugya there, Daf Zayin, Daf Chet, and Pesachim, that no, maybe the Chachamim formally instituted the use of a candle. So maybe you should use a candle, even in addition to a flashlight. I once asked Moriv Ravi Rav Tendler Zatzal about using a flashlight for Bidikat Chametz. And he said, yeah, you could use a flashlight to get underneath the bed, get underneath the sofa, but at least you should light a candle at the beginning. You know, light a candle. The Chachamim told you that you should make Bidikat Chametz or Haner. Maybe it's a takana. Maybe it's part of the takana. They bring psukim, which maybe it's an asmachta, but it's part of the takana, la'or haner. And so even though maybe you're going to go underneath the bed or the sofa with the flashlight, Moriv Rabbi Rav Tendler Zatzal said that that at least you should light a candle at the beginning of Bidikat Chametz, walk around with it a little bit, but again, safety first. Okay. Now there, in the Gemara brings a number of psukim to teach that yes, we have to make Bidikat Chametz by the light of a candle. And one of the pasukim that the Gemara brings is here in source number 3, a pasuk from Mishle Perek Chaf, from the book of Proverbs, chapter 20. Ner Hashem Nishmat Adam, Chofes Kol Chadrei Vaten. The soul of a man, the nishama of a man, is a candle of Hashem. Right? We have inside of us a spark of the divine, a piece of godly light. And he reveals and searches in all of his innermost parts. Kol chadrei vaten. Hashem ki'ilu takes that candle that's inside every individual, that candle of God, and like we do with Bidikat Chametz, by using the candle and searching with that, Hashem searches and seeks and looks at our lives. In addition to the candle, you know, takes a magnifying glass, right? And so based on this pasuk, my Rebbe Rav Tendler explained that, yes, this is why you want to use a candle, because ultimately, the candle at Bidikat Chametz, even if you're not going to go under the bed with it, and I urge you not to put a candle under your beds, okay? The candle represents how Hashem examines each and every one of us, and how Bidikat Chametz is a time not just to examine the home and look for Chametz in the home, but to examine oneself and to find the Chametz in one's soul. Okay? So Bidikat Chametz becomes a time for some serious self-reflection and soul-searching. And then, of course, what do you do with the Chametz that you find? You burn it. There's biur chametz. The next morning you burn the chametz with fire. And here, if you take a look at source number 4, this is a mishnah from the second perek. Rabbi Yehuda omer, ein biur chametz ela srefa. According to Rabbi Yehuda, you have to burn the chametz. The chachamim omrim, no. The rabbis say, af mefarer vizorela ruach, you can break it up and scatter it into the wind. O matil layam. Or you can scatter it into the sea. Give it a burial at sea, right? What do we do when Erev Pesach falls out on Shabbat and you can't burn the chametz because it's Shabbat? What do? We flush the chametz down the toilet, right? Or a couple of years ago when we were all in lockdown, that first Pesach during the corona epidemic, when the pandemic was sort of at its height, for many people, they couldn't go out. There were not these public chametz burnings, right? So what did people do? I told people in my shul, you could just flush the chametz down the toilet, and it's sufficient to do it that way, to dispose of it that way. But some say that lechatchila, maybe no, preferably it should be burned, and that's what we do when it's possible, okay? Preferably maybe it should be burned, and so you see this idea that bedikat chametz is a time where we, again, not only search the home for chametz, search in all the cracks and crevices, all the nooks and crannies of the home, but also search the soul and all the cracks and crevices of the heart and soul, all the nooks and crannies of one's personality, and rid the chametz, the yetzer hara, these negative character traits, these things from one's personality, and then what do? You burn them, and you have to burn them with a fire, some explain. Okay, and in fact, take a look at source number 5. This is a tefillah. There are different versions of this, but this is a tefillah that is found in many Haggadot to accompany the Biur Chametz. There's a Yehi Ratzon that many say was composed by Kabbalists, a Yehi Ratzon where one asks, Hashem, just as I am burning v'chametz, I am destroying, I've fulfilled this mitzvah of seek and destroy. I've searched the home in all the nooks and crannies, all the cracks and crevices, ridding the home of chametz, and now destroying the chametz. So too, Hashem, you should destroy the yetzer hara within us and the ruach hatum'ah and all of these bad things, and give us a lev basar, and get rid of the sitra achra, the evil side, okay? And get rid of all of these things. Kol harisha ke'ashan tichleh, v'tavir memshelet zadon min ha'aretz, borrowing from the nusach ha'tfilah of the Yamim Hanoraim, okay? And many have the custom to say this, because again, we're not only burning the chametz, and destroying the chametz, but symbolically we're trying to get rid of those negative character traits. Now, what exactly are we talking about? The Radbaz says we have to get rid of the sa'or shebe'isa, the leaven in the dough. And the source of the Radbaz is the Gemara here at the bottom of the first side, here in source number 6. It's a Gemara in Masechet Brachot and Daf Yud Zayin. The Gemara there lists different tefillot that different chachamim would recite following their own personal tefillah, following their own amidah. They would add a tefillah. The Rabbi Alexandri batar dematzlei, after he would pray, amar hachi, he would say the following, Ribon ha'olamim, master of worlds, galui v'yadu alafanecha, it is revealed and known before you, sheritzoneinu la'asot ritzoncha, our will is to do your will, Hashem, Umi ma'akev, but what prevents us? Se'or shebi'isa, the leaven in the dough, v'shibud malchiot, and the subjugation or servitude to foreign powers, foreign nations. Now we understand this. We understand how while in Egypt, and we'll come back to this maybe in a few moments, while in Egypt, because of the shibud mitzrayim, the Jewish people were unable to serve Hashem, unable to fulfill their potential. And in the galut, in the exile, because of the foreign rule, foreign dominion, okay, we too are unable to truly serve Hashem in the most ideal way. We are unable to achieve our national potential. So we understand how shibud malchiot prevents us, how that is ma'akev. But what is the Se'or Shebi'isa? What does Rabbi Alexandri mean? What is he teaching us when he says, Hashem, it's our will to do your will, but what's stopping us? What's preventing us? It's the leaven in the dough. What does that mean? So take a look at the top of the next page. Rashi explains it's the Yetzer Hara Shebil Vaveinu, it's the evil inclination in our hearts, Hamach Mitzenu. The Se'or Shebi'isa, the leaven in the dough, it's the Yetzer Hara in our hearts, that what? That becomes chametz. What does that mean? What is Rashi trying to tell us? What's going on? What does the Yetzer Hara do, really? What does chametz represent? So some explain that what Rashi's talking about is ego, inflated ego. The Yetzer Hara, right? What is that about? Yetzer Hara shebil vavenu hamach mitzenu. Just like when dough rises, right? It gets full of hot air, right? If you cut into a good piece of bread or a good piece of challah, right? That has risen properly, you'll notice, oh, there's all these little air pockets in it, all these little holes in it, right? Because however it works, what's it called in the dough when you put the yeast? Thank you. I'm starting to forget my English. You've been living here in Israel long enough, and you start forgetting your English. You still can't speak Hebrew, but then you start forgetting your English, and so then you're completely unintelligible. Right, Yiddish. So, the yeast feeds on the sugar and releases, what, gases that cause the bread to rise. So chametz ultimately represents ego, inflated ego. It's full of hot air. And that's the Yetzer Hara. And that's what's so dangerous about chametz. Chametz represents that inflated ego, which is the root of all evil, that needs to be found, right? Needs to be found and destroyed, just like chametz. That's one way of looking at things. But what is chametz, after all? Right? In fact, if you really think about it, matzah and chametz are really the same. They're the same ingredients that go into making matzah can become chametz. In fact, the Mishnah says that you can only fulfill the mitzvah of matzah with things that have potential to become chametz. You can only fulfill the mitzvah of achilat matzah with things that can become chametz, because they are the same thing. They're two sides of the same coin. They're made of the same ingredients. But what's the one difference between chametz and matzah in one word? What's the difference between chametz and matzah in one word? Time. Time. If you let it go and let it wait and rise, then it becomes chametz. And if you've ever been to a matzah factory and you see the balagan and the craziness, why are they going crazy? They're making matzah. No. Because the same very matzah, the very same matzah can turn into chametz if you allow it to. Okay? So the difference between chametz and matzah in one word, time. And maybe that is what is so tragic, if you will, about what chametz represents. Chazal teach, mitzvah habat liyadcha al tachmitzena. When the opportunity to perform a mitzvah arises, don't let it become chametz. Take a look here at source number 8. Ushmartem et hamatzot. There's a mitzvah to safeguard the matzah. What does that mean? Safeguard it from becoming chametz, or perhaps the matzah that you use for the mitzvah at the Seder has to be baked for the sake of the mitzvah of matzah. Okay? And that becomes a major point of contention with the controversy that took place first in Europe in the 19th century, and then eventually it crossed over the Mediterranean, if you will, here in Israel, a number of decades later, regarding machine matzah. Right? Must matzah be baked with kavanah, with intent to fulfill the mitzvah, for the sake of the mitzvah? L'shem matzah is mitzvah! L'shem mitzvah is matzah! Right? Or is it sufficient that the one operating the machine, pushing the button, says l'shem matzah is mitzvah, and has the proper intent? Okay, but the Torah says, Ushmartem et hamatzot, you are to safeguard the matzot. Shmura, right? You've heard of shmura matzah. And different explanations from at what point it has to be guarded. Okay? Mishat ktsira, mishat lisha. Without going into that, the Torah says you are to safeguard the matzot. Now, our Torah is written without vowels. It's not a vocalized text. So you could read that same pasuk, Ushmartem et ha mitzvot, safeguard the commandments. And in fact, according to Rabbi Yoshia, there's this play on words. He darshans this pasuk. He says, there's this additional level of interpretation. He makes this linguistic connection, this mischak milim, this play on words. And Rabbi Yoshia says the following, Al tikra ken, ela ushmartem et hamitzvot. Don't read it, ushmartem et hamatzot, safeguard the matzah. Read it, ushmartem et hamitzvot. Safeguard the commandments. Kiderech she'ein machmitzin et hamatzah, kach ein machmitzin et hamitzvah. Just as you don't let the dough become chametz, don't let your observance of mitzvot become chametz. Don't wait. When the opportunity rises, take it, right? Rises. No pun intended. Don't let a mitzvah become chametz. Don't miss out on the opportunity. Ela im ba mitzvah liyadcha aseh otah. tamid. When a mitzvah comes into your hand, do it right away. So, ultimately, chametz represents missed opportunity. Missed opportunity. The loss of potential. Mitzvah habaliyatcha al tachmitzena. When you have the opportunity to do something, don't let it become chametz. In fact, even in modern Hebrew, the modern Hebrew word for missed opportunity is what? Hachmatzah. Hachmatzah tasha. Sound familiar? Hachmatzah from chametz. It's this loss of potential. It's missed opportunity, which is the saddest thing. And maybe that is what is so devastating, so debilitating, so dangerous about chametz. Because in addition to representing inflated ego, gaiva, all of these things, the Yetzer Hara, ultimately it represents missed opportunity. And that is the saddest of things. While slaves in Mitzrayim, the Jewish nation suffered from a paralysis. They were being spiritually suffocated. They could not even hear Hashem's promise of redemption. Moshe comes to them, and the Torah says they could not hear the words of Moshe, this promise of redemption. It fell upon deaf ears. Why? Because of the Avodah Kasha and the Kotzer Ruach. Now, the Avodah Kasha we understand, right? When a person's hard at work, it's very hard to listen. Maybe you've experienced this with your kids or grandkids. You're busy with something and you're so focused on this, especially if you're working from home, like during the pandemic, and your child is trying to get your attention and you're not hearing them. Or maybe your wife is trying to get your attention and you're not hearing her. It never happens, right? Never happens. Only to me. And so we can understand why the back-breaking labor prevented the Jewish people from hearing this promise of redemption. It didn't seem possible, but they were so occupied by this backbreaking labor, they couldn't hear anything. They were so distracted, maybe. But what's the kotzer ruach, this shortness of breath, or really shortness of spirit? They were lacking some sort of ruach, some sort of spirit. So again, they were being spiritually suffocated. There's this malaise, this paralysis. The name for Egypt is what? Mitzrayim. It comes from the word mitzar, implying narrowness, constriction, limitations. The bondage in Egypt wasn't merely a physical slavery, but a mental one. In Egypt, the Jewish nation could not achieve its potential, could not fulfill its destiny. Each and every one of us has our own personal Mitzrayim, our own personal Egypt. Something in our lives that's holding us back, preventing us from achieving our goals. Some block or hurdle that stands between us and destiny. But Pesach is Chag HaAviv, the springtime holiday. And as Chag HaAviv, it represents renewal. Spring is here in Yerushalayim, the sun is shining, the flowers are in bloom, the birds are chirping. Although the last few days it's been a little colder than usual, especially at night. But spring is in the air, the sun is shining, the birds are singing, the feeling of rebirth and renewal in the air, it's palpable, it's tangible, it's this new beginning. So as we scrub our counters and scour our stoves and kosher our ovens and pots and pans, it's a time to break free from whatever's holding us back in life. And that's what Pesach is about. And so chametz represents whatever is holding us back. Chametz represents that missed opportunity. And what do we read on Pesach? We read Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs. Now there are many reasons why we read Shir HaShirim on Pesach. But I think one is just simply rooted in the narrative of Shir HaShirim, and we'll see how it's related to this theme of Pesach as a time of renewal and chametz as a symbol of missed opportunity. Shir HaShirim is the greatest love song ever sung, the greatest love story ever told. It's the story of the love between God and the Jewish people. Of course, it's an allegory about the God, the love between Hashem and His bride Israel, the Jewish people, the nation of Israel. But it takes the form of a love story. And the two lovers are describing one another in graphic detail. They're describing their great love for one another. But it's fascinating. It's the greatest love story, but it's a story, it's a tragic love story. It's a story of unrequited love because the two lovers never meet. And so for the first four or five chapters, they are describing their great love for one another. I should say the first four chapters, they're describing their great love for one another and describing one another in detail. And then in the fifth chapter, the climax of the story, the Dod finally comes to the garden of the Raya. Bati lagani yachoti kala. He comes to her garden. Okay? They've been longing for one another. And here, in the fifth chapter, the climax of the story, he finally comes to her garden. And he's knocking. And she hears it, but she's asleep. She's already in for the night. Ani yishena velibi er. But she hears him knocking. Kol dodi dofek. Pitchili achoti rayati yonati tamati. Open up. Open up, my sister, my love, my dove. Right? And what does she say? It's so tragic. She says, oh, I'm already in for the night. Pashatati et kutonti. Echecha al beshena. I've already taken off my clothes. How am I going to get dressed now? I'm in my pajamas. Right? That ever happened to you? Where maybe your wife notices there's no more milk left. Oh, what are we going to have tomorrow morning in our coffee? Can you go to the makolet and buy a bag of milk? Buy a bag of milk? Pashatati et kutonti. I'm already in for the night. I'm in my pajamas. You want me to first start getting dressed? Rachatzti et raglai. Echecha atanafeim. I've already washed my feet, she says. How can I soil them walking to the door? It's so tragic. And finally, sof, by the time she puts something on and, you know, she's covered in all sorts of oils and myrrhs and she goes to the door and it's so tragic, her hand, because of all these oils and myrrhs and all that schmutz, her hand slips off the doorknob and he's putting his hand through the keyhole. He's trying to grasp for her. And when she finally gets to the door and opens the door, it's so sad. The three saddest words in all of Shir HaShirim, perhaps in all of Tanakh, V'dodi chamak avar. My lover has turned and left. He's gone. It's too late. And she chases after him into the street and she gets accosted. But the two lovers never meet. So while Shir HaShirim is the greatest love story ever told, ultimately it's a tragic love story. It's a story of unrequited love. The two lovers never meet. They keep missing one another. Like strangers in the night, right? Like two ships passing. And Reb Soloveitchik, in his Kol Dodi Dofek, his famous essay, where he deals with Jewish history and destiny and suffering and loss and also the birth of the State of Israel, he draws heavily from Shir HaShirim and calls it a story of hachmatzat hasha'ah, of missed potential. And maybe that's one reason why we read Shir HaShirim on Pesach, because chametz ultimately represents that loss of potential, that missed opportunity. Here the lover is knocking on the door. Open up, open up. They've been longing for each other. They've been dreaming about meeting. And when he finally comes to her garden, she misses the opportunity. It's too late. It's the saddest thing. It's so tragic. And that is what ultimately the Seor Shebe'isa represents. The chametz in the dough. The leaven in the dough. Because the one difference between chametz and matzah is time. So chametz represents that missed opportunity, that lost potential. Okay? And so as we, again, search our homes in all those nooks and crannies, all the cracks and the crevices, b'charim u'zdakim. We also have to search in our souls, in our hearts, for the things that maybe we're not achieving, the parts of ourselves that we could do better in, the areas in life where we can put a little more effort. Ask ourselves, are we achieving our true potential? Because that ultimately is what the chametz represents. And then, of course, we have to rid the home of the chametz and rid ourselves of those areas in life that require improvement. Are we achieving our true potential? So as we scrub and scour the counters and the kasher, the ovens, and clean the pots and pans, and it's a time to break free from whatever is holding us back. It's a time to ask ourselves, are we achieving our potential? Both as individuals and as a nation. In Nisan, we were redeemed. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah and Daf Yud Aleph says, and in Nisan, we will be redeemed in the future. This is the season of redemption, both national and personal. It's a new beginning. It's a new start. May it be a Pesach of health and wellness, renewal and redemption, both national redemption and personal redemption. I wish you all a Chag Kasher V'Sameach.